today is Palm Sunday, and today derives its name from the procession traditionally made on this day. That tradition traces back to Jerusalem in the 4th century. The Emperor Constantine and his mother Helena invested in the construction of shrines and churches at the various holy sites around the city. These locations, in turn, became the focus of various dramatic processions and reenactments and vigils, particularly during what came to be called Great Week, or what we now call Holy Week. The Palm Sunday procession began on the Mount of Olives and saw the bishop escorted into the city riding on a donkey as the crowd sang and waved palm branches, such as you have in your own hands this morning. Pilgrims who came to attend these processions and goings-on during Holy Week would go back to their hometowns, sometimes hundreds of miles away, and they would start those in their own places, and so the customs spread around the empire. The processional practice reached all the way to Rome and was observed there, as far as we know, from the 6th century forward. But the ceremony involving the blessing and distribution of palms to people, such as we did today, came later, originating in the Gallican churches in the 9th or 10th century. As far as the liturgy of the day is historically concerned, the focus has always been on the reading of the Passion, which you heard from Father Davidson this morning. The blessing and the processional ceremonies involving palms came later, as I mentioned, and we're not, strictly speaking, part of the service. But on this Sunday, the epistle, which is Philippians 2, 5 through 11, has been read since the beginning of the Christian era, recounting the humility of Jesus, while the gospel, historically, is both the 26th and the 27th chapter of Matthew. We just read part of the 27th today. These begin Holy Week, the reading of Jesus' Passion. Today, it's from Matthew. Tuesday, in your prayer book, it will be from Mark. Wednesday, it will be from Luke. And on Friday, we gather, and it will be from St. John. In the Middle Ages, these long passion narratives were chanted, with different cantors taking on the roles of the characters in the drama, and the choir taking on the part of the Jewish mob. We still do that today when we read St. John on Good Friday. Following the Reformation, this tradition carried on, particularly in Lutheran churches, and believe it or not, this chanting underlies the great compositions which would be known as the Passion Oratorios of Johann Sebastian Bach. The Reformers, however, were ever concerned with superstitions associated with the blessing of anything, and they saw the palms as a distraction from the word by ceremonies. Now you see our children today have quietly set them aside and proving the Reformers wrong. No such distraction. In fact, in 1549, Thomas Cranmer did away with the extraneous ceremonies associated with Palm Sunday, which in the Book of Common Prayer was simply titled the Sunday next before Easter. Palm Sunday, however, persisted in common usage because people like you just liked Palm Sunday better and didn't like the English term of the phrase, the Sunday next, before Easter. So they kept using their willow branches and palm branches, and we thank Father Davidson this morning for resisting Cranmer. It isn't really possible to cover the entire lessons today in one homily, and you wouldn't want me to do that anyway. They're not offered to us for that purpose. They're read at length so that you can be still, just listen to the story, take it in. So I'll be selective, and I hope that I can encourage you. Whether we read St. Matthew's narrative of the Passion or his telling of that first Palm Sunday, today's epistle is the lens through which we read today's gospel. What took Matthew two long chapters to tell, St. Paul summarizes in 36 Greek words. This is what he said. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus,
who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. It is breathtakingly brief in the original, twice as long in the English. The poem brilliantly and succinctly sums up who Jesus is, as it draws on both Israel's story and the story of the whole fallen human race. Kings and emperors grasped at divinity, men like Pharaoh, Alexander, Caesar, and even many of Israel's own leaders in the Old Testament, and in Jesus' day, and in Paul's day, grasped for such power. They knew better than to claim divinity, as many of the pagan rulers would do, but still they grasped for the same power that Caesar held, and sought to control the reins of empire in hopes of one day climbing to the top of the heap. This was not merely the problem of kings or would-be kings. This has been a problem for the entire human race. We fight, we kill, we steal, we cheat. We do whatever we can do, whatever we can get away with, to look out for ourselves and to get what we want. I know you're not Caesar or Alexander or Pharaoh, but the spirit of all of those lives in each one of us. You're not a king, are you? You're not a powerful person. You're just a nobody like me. But you know, each of us has our own kingdom, and each of our kingdoms have people in them that need bossing around and exploiting, dominating. Some people in my kingdom need governing. It started with me way back in early childhood. I remember looking across the breakfast table at my brother pouring the cereal out of the box while we both watched for the prize to fall out. In my kingdom, the prize was always mine. And he was part of my kingdom, and he had to give me the prize. He would pour his bowl, and I'd look at him across the table, and I'd pour my bowl, and then he'd go back for seconds. And then I would go for seconds. It all depended on where it started a day or two before. It was really bad when the cousins came to spend the night at grandmother's house. We'd get up in the morning with four or five around the table, and grandma would put out a new box of Captain Crunch with a prize inside, and there were five green children. And everybody would watch to see the first person. We knew he wouldn't get the prize. It was in the bottom of the box, but maybe it would go all the way around the table and just in time for the prize to fall out. It's all a matter of who picked up the box first. Grown-ups do this too, and it's not quite as funny. We do it with our spouses. We do it at the office. God knows our children do it. And the Lord's solution to humanity's problem was to call forth a people for himself, a people who live in his presence for the life of the whole world, a nation of servants. Israel understood this to be her role. And of course, Israel suffered from the same problem as the rest of humanity. And Paul uses this hymn to show us the solution, how God humbled himself. Jesus, whom the hymn says was in the form of God, who in some way was God himself, emptied himself to take on Adam's flesh and Israel's servant role. Paul is clear that this doesn't mean that Jesus ceased to be God or that he gave up his divinity in some way. It's just the opposite. Jesus here shows us what true divinity actually looks like. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross. So now we fast forward to the narrative that we heard at length this morning, to a small part that's often told, and most of us know it pretty well, but it's never the subject of homilies. I'm referring to the bit about Judas, whom we easily put into a short column of horrible people like Nero or Caligula or Genghis Khan or Mao or Hitler. But let's think about him briefly. I know you don't see yourself in Judas. You wouldn't name your dog Judas. But maybe we shouldn't be too quick to be dismissive. Judas was called, as you will recall, as one of the 12.
He walked with Jesus for 3 years and saw what everybody else saw from the front row. That should immediately provide a point of contact. The children in the room have been brought to Christ by your parents, raised in faith, participated in the sacraments, and so on and so on. We don't quite know what Judas' motive was for betraying Jesus. Was it money? Okay, 30 pieces of silver might have been something. Assuming it was 1 ounce rounds, and assuming we just put it at spot price and that it closed at last Friday, it's about $700. Certainly wasn't $1 million. Did he betray Jesus in the hope of provoking a showdown between Jesus and the authorities? Did he do it in hope that Jesus would actually call a bunch of angels and show everybody just who he was? Did Judas somehow just come to hate Jesus? To despise him as some sort of fraud that he wanted to expose? We don't know. We do know enough to know that he was conflicted. We know that he was trusted with the money the disciples maintained, and we know also that he helped himself to it from time to time. We also know that he was of a divided mind. As James would later say, a double-minded man is unstable in all of his ways. It is a particularly suspenseful scene at the Last Supper, which we did not read today, when Jesus announces to the whole group that one of them would betray him. This set off a storm of whispering as the question, is it I? It's not me. Was muttered through the beards of the disciples one by one. Peter, sitting across the room, motioning to John, who's next to Jesus, we're told, saying, but then there was that fateful moment when Jesus reached into the dish at the same time as Judas, both of them putting their hand there, and then Jesus taking the bread. In exactly the same way, I or Father Davidson would in the Eucharist, this being the first. Jesus hands him the bread and puts it in his palm, as if to say, this is my body which is given for you. Eat this bread in remembrance and be thankful. The body of Christ preserves your body and soul to everlasting life. Jesus could not have been more clear. And Judas appears to be somewhat startled and says, it's not me, is it? Now I know that we're not Greek speakers here, but a couple of us can read it, and it's clear from the text that in that moment, Judas expects a negative answer. We can write a question in Greek so as to show to the reader what the expected answer is. I can write it in such a way as to include a particular negative that expects someone to say, yeah. Or I can write it with a different negative and it would expect someone to say, no. We can't do this in English, but we do it with tone of voice. It's not me, is it? And I'm expecting you to say, no. Or I can say, it's me, isn't it? And you'd say, yeah. Judas takes the bread from Jesus' hand and says, it's not me. He expects Jesus to say no. Even moments before he succumbs to the temptation, he was of a divided mind. He did not see himself or expect himself capable of such a thing. Somehow he rationalized away what he was being tempted to do, the same way that he had rationalized away dipping into the pot of money and taking a little bit for himself wasn't really hurting anybody after all. A long series of small transgressions made it possible for Judas to do what he did. A long series of smaller transgressions made him dismissive of what sin was really like and made him underestimate and miscalculate the gravity of what he was doing. Does that happen to us? Sure, a quick look at the wrong internet site, shading the truth here just a little bit, or
cheating just a smidge on the contract. We can dismiss those things as one-offs, right? But they become long habits that are ingrained, which make it very easy for us to fail in the greater moment. Somehow Judas had rationalized everything away, and he stuffed the bread of life into his mouth and ran out of the room into the waiting conference of priests, with whom he would cut a bribe for cooperating with an arrest. It's not likely that Judas expected at all for things to go as badly as they did. And here we pick up the story with today's gospel. Judas leads the guard to the garden where he knew Jesus would be after dark. He singled Jesus out with a kiss, and they took him into custody. Again, it isn't clear what Judas thought would happen, but by morning it didn't matter. Matthew says, when Judas, his betrayer, saw that Jesus was condemned, he changed his mind and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, I've sinned by betraying innocent blood. They said, in the Greek, what the hell is that to us? We cleaned it up a little bit. What is that to us? See to it yourself. They scoffed at him. And throwing down the pieces of silver into the temple with a clatter, he ran out and hanged himself. How did we get there? For $700. As Judas realized what was going to happen, he regretted his decision. And note the irony. He returned to the temple and confessed his sins, but the priests refused him. Judas throws their payment to the floor, unable to resolve his guilt, and goes out and commits suicide. Now, folks, we don't have to be Old Testament scholars to know that the central task of the priest was to make atonement for sin. But when Judas goes to them with his guilt, he's rejected and turned away. Matthew reminds us here that the days of the temple are at an end. But here we see the priests themselves forsaking their central duty and complicit in the guilt. The time for a new temple, this one not made with hands, was about to come. And then, as if to keep up the charade, the self-righteous priests pick up the coins off the floor where they had rolled under the tables. Down on their hands and knees, wasn't that a sight? And they say, it's not lawful to put this in the treasury since it's blood money. Is it? So they took counsel and they had to figure out for a few minutes what to do. And then they did something remarkable. They unconsciously reenacted three scenes from the Old Testament all at once. They went out and borrowed potter's field as a burial place for strangers. And the field has been called the field of blood or the field of slaughter in the Old Testament to this day. Then what was fulfilled, what had been spoken by the prophet Jeremiah, who says, they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of him on whom a price had been set by some of the sons of Israel, and they gave them for the potter's field as the Lord directed me. Now, if you go home this afternoon and try to look this up, you're going to get frustrated. It's there in Jeremiah, but it probably refers to the scroll of Jeremiah, which includes Jeremiah through the end of the end of the Old Testament. There was one big scroll in Jesus' day. Part of this takes place in Jeremiah 19, Jeremiah 32, Zechariah 11, and Exodus 21. Four times in the Old Testament, we get potters, we get fields, we get silver. And all this conflates in one moment in the life of Jesus. For example, in Jeremiah 19, Jeremiah was instructed to go and take a potter's flask, like a pot. And he was supposed to go out into the city, into a field that was called Tophet, but which would, when Jeremiah was done, be called the field of blood. And he was to take the potter's vessel and shattered into pieces so that it could never be put back together again. And the prophetic message acted out in this ritual was that Judah was about to be scattered and it was over for them in judgment. the high priest just reenacted it. We could go again to another place in Jeremiah, where Jeremiah buys a field during the siege of Jerusalem in 586 BC. Now, let me tell you, real estate at that moment is cheap. He's told to buy a field because there was a promise of God that one day people would return and they would discover the hiding beads and people would live there again, not in fear. Redemption was in view. Jeremiah buys a worthless field for 17 shekels of silver and a cloth. Zechariah 11, the prophet is ritually and visionarily made to be a shepherd over sheep. But the sheep are like goats, they're rambunctious, and they won't obey the shepherd. And there are foreign sheep traders who come in and randomly kill the sheep, and the sheep like them better than they like their shepherd. Finally, the shepherd just gets frustrated with it and says, I'm leaving, just pay me my wages, what I've earned. And the sheep traders are happy to do that. And here's what the shepherd said: it seems good to you, give me my wages, but if not, keep them. Whatever you want to do. So they weighed out to me 30 pieces of silver. And the Lord said, throw it in the potter. And the Lord be priced, which I was priced by them. So they took the 30 pieces of silver and threw it into the house of the Lord. Through the potter. The priest reenacted all of this in just a few moments. Free from the Old Testament. Oh, they acted out of court as well. And this one is not so familiar to us, and it's not in view of the New Testament, but it's out there. There's this strange passage in Exodus 21, rules about what happens if you have an ox that gores. In our day, it might be like a dog that bites, a German shepherd, or a pit bull, or something like that. And the rules go something like this: when an ox gores a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall not be liable. But if the ox is known to gore, like if he's pushed before, he looks a little wild, and people say, hey, don't go to that field because that ox will stick you. And everybody knows this. And if you don't keep that ox penned up, the owner has been warned but has not kept it in, and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and the owner shall be put to death because it's criminal negligence. And then there's this interesting footnote that falls strangely on our ears. If the ox gores a slave or a male or a female, the owner shall give the master 30 pieces of silver. We know who the ox is in this passage. That's a clean animal. That's a priestly sacrificial beast. And we also know that this ox had long since, over and over, pushed and gored and killed prophet after prophet after prophet, all the way to John the Baptist. And they were about to gore one more time. But they weren't going to gore just anybody. They were going to gore a slave, a servant, that we might be free. And that's what they did. And you know what the price of the servant was? 30 pieces of silver. This brings us back to the lens of the epistle lesson. Paul doesn't simply tell us this so that we can better understand who Jesus is. He tells us so we better understand what he's done. Paul has a very practical reason for writing this to the Philippian Christians. Jesus' people are supposed to have this mind, this mindset. That's why he's done what he's done, to solve the problem that began when Adam grasped at divinity for himself. To solve the problem that little John had with a stupid cereal box protecting his kingdom, waiting for the cheap prize to fall out. And also for you, with equally cheap prizes that you continue to do in your grown-up life. And as we identify with Jesus, we become a part of the renewed servant people of God. We're forgiven for our past grasping, for our past selfishness, and we're filled with God's own Spirit. And as the Spirit turns our hearts and minds to the self-giving God, we become a people whose chief characteristic is self-giving
humility.
We all have our kingdoms to protect, don't we? We all see ourselves in some small way in the characters around the events of the Passion. Time forbids us to talk about Pilate and the people around the cross and the Jewish mob. To these, there's a story in every one of them. We could think about that thief. That thief who joined in, by the way, with the other thief in spitting and marauding at Jesus. But just moments before he passed, he turned to Jesus and repented himself. And he said, "Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Let us forsake our own kingdoms. And let us pray that prayer. And may God make us part.